Welcome to On the Line with the AMA, the official podcast of the American Motorcyclist Association. I'm Alexandra Terhorst. Our guests today are custom bike builder Dave Perowitz and his daughter Jody. Inducted into the AMA Motorcycle Hall of Fame in 2003, Dave has been creating world-class custom American V-twins since the 1970s. Jody grew up in the business and her focus is on American-made street bikes. A decade ago, she and Dave developed an interest in land speed racing that quickly grew into a passion. Today, she holds 16 land speed records, all on American motorcycles. But that's the tip of the iceberg of their story, which begins in the 1960s.
When I was a kid, I was very interested in hot rod cars. When I got my license, I started hanging around with a bunch of older guys that had hot rod cars, and I worked on cars. I was a mechanic. And then after a very short time, the guys that I was hanging with started buying motorcycles and kind of going away from the hot rod car stuff and going into bikes. So I kind of followed suit because, you know, I liked motorcycles. I liked just the mechanics. I bought my first bike in 1969, a 1964 Sportster. Back then, there's hardly anybody that had big twins around here. This was one of the parts of the country that was just all Sportsters. And when I was in high school, I hung around a body shop. I always watched my friend and his father paint cars and do body work. And so I decided I was going to paint my first motorcycle. So I talked to a couple of other guys in body shops that I knew. And I wanted to do it in candy paint, which I didn't know anything about. And so I put together my first spray booth, which was a 5x10 lawnmower shed that my father had, and we put an old kitchen fan in the wall, and I got a little Craftsman compressor, and I did my first paint job, and it came out really cool. So a couple of my friends said, well, geez, will you paint my bike? So I said, sure. So one thing led to another. Basically, the last job I had was 1970. I was a line mechanic at a local Chevy dealer, and I worked in a machine shop at night. So I quit my job and I started working on motorcycles, which was very difficult back then. There was no such thing as a bike builder, and there was very few people making any money doing motorcycles. But, you know, I did whatever I had to do to make ends meet, and I built my first shop in my father's backyard in 1971. It was a building a little bigger than a one-car garage, and we put a little spray booth in it, and, you know, it was a neat little shop, and I did everything in there. I cut frames and raked frames and welded them back together, and I did body work, and I did paint. And I put the bikes together. So I was pretty much a one-man shop. As time went on, I naturally got busier and busier. And in 1975, I met Alan Ness. And Alan was truly my mentor, and he was my really good friend. We became really good friends right away. We met at a big show in Detroit. It was in April. And I invited him to Laconia, which is in June. So he said, sure, I'll come. So he sent his bike out here. And I picked up his bike, and then he flew out. I met him at the airport, and we went to Laconia, and we had a great time. He had never been out here in the East Coast. And on Sunday, we were getting ready to go home, and he said, hey, you want to take a trip to Detroit? I know a bunch of guys in Detroit. We could go out there and hang out for a while and ride. And I'm like, sure. So we put his bike and my bike in the back of my old van, and we drove to Detroit. And we hooked up with all the big guys in Detroit, which was Yosemite Sam Brothers were like probably the biggest custom guys at the time. And then Ron Finch and Carlini and a few others. We spent a week out there riding and hanging with all those guys. And then my business just kind of went from there. And I got bigger and bigger over the years and built a lot of bikes and did a lot of traveling. And I traveled with Alan a lot. And in 1977, Alan called me one day and he said, hey, I heard about this big rally in South Dakota called Sturgis. You want to go? And I said, well, geez, that's a long ways for me. He says, well, listen, why don't you fly out there and I'll bring you a bike? I said, okay. So I flew out. Alan brought me a bike. And that was the first year I went to Sturgis. And I've been in Sturgis every year since 77.
I obviously grew up on motorcycles, was what we did. I have an older brother, and whatever he did, I wanted to do, and I was fortunate enough that he always let me. So it was riding dirt bikes in 50s and four-wheelers and whatever we had. I mean, we were outside on something with a motor all the time. As I got older, it turned into obviously full-size motorcycles. And I went to college, and about halfway through college, I kind of, I don't want to say lost interest, but I didn't want to go to school anymore. I wanted to ride motorcycles and be more involved in the business. But my dad said, you want to work, you have to finish school. So I did exactly that. I finished college with my bachelor's degree, actually in political science. And then shortly after, I started working for the business.
In 2003, we did the first biker build off for Discovery Channel, which was just a great time. We rode from Florida to Texas, and I brought 60 people with me. We sent 12 trucks and trailers to Pensacola, Florida, and I had all my friends from all over the country that came with us, and we just had an awesome time. My whole family was there. My son Jesse and my daughter Jody both riding bikes. That was really a big deal. That was the start of all the bike TV stuff. And I did quite a few TV shows, which built up my popularity. And I used it to promote myself, which really paid off. So we were getting paid to do shows. And then everything kind of crashed around 2012, 13, 14. And we downsized, and we're in a great spot now. It's a little bit off the road, very small crew. And we build bikes. We do a lot of paint work. We do general repairs. But I really pick and choose what we do. We're doing a lot of old bike stuff. We're doing a lot of restorations, and we're doing 246 knuckleheads right now. I'm building a pan head. We've got a shovel head bobber that we're building. So a lot of stuff going on. We're doing paint shows all over the country now. And what that is it's a Perowitz Paint Show, which is a custom bike show judged on paint jobs only. We do them at all the major bike rallies. We have a panel of custom painters that come in and judge each show. Jody and I don't judge any shows. We have a lot of sponsors. We have a lot of great prizes. And all of the top awards are all hand-painted trophies by myself, Jody, and lots of other custom painters around the country.
Jody's life has been all about breaking barriers, from riding dirt bikes as a kid to getting a full scholarship to college to earning the respect of old school bikers. But when she and Dave set their sights on breaking land speed records in Bonneville, they faced a challenge of unknown proportions.
In 2010, I gave my dad a trip to Bonneville for Christmas. It was one of the few places that he had never been. And we said, well, if we're going to go to Bonneville, we can't go and not race. And I said, well, I would love to ride something. And we were able to get some really good sponsors and companies behind us to help us build a motorcycle. And in 2011, we went out to the Bonneville Salt Flats with a 100 cubic inch V-twin with a supercharger on it. And before we got out there, I did some research, and there had been no female on an American motorcycle to go over 200. So that instantly became our goal to go 200, to be the first female on an American bike, which is our bread and butter at our business, to go 200. And when we got out there, we told a couple of people, that's like the big question at Bonneville is, oh, how fast do you want to go? And when we said 200, it got to the point where people were literally laughing at us, because that's such a magical number out at Bonneville that it's so hard to get to that number, that us being rookies and not races. I mean, I'm not a racer. I had no racing background other than riding in the cornfield against my brother when we were little. So we were really rookies. And that first year, on the last day, I made a pass at 203 miles per hour. So it was a little bittersweet, because we were so excited, and because we were rookies. Out at Bonneville, you have to be able to back it up. You have to do another run in the opposite direction. And we went to back it up, and I broke a valve. So that year, we didn't actually get a record over 200. We did set a bunch of records, but we didn't get one over 200, but I did make a pass at 200. So it was bittersweet, but it just made us come back the next year. And we went back for the next 7 years to Bonneville, and I currently hold 16 land speed records. And I've raced two different motorcycles, both American V-twins.
When we took on the job of building a bike for Bonneville, I had no experience at all with it. But what I do have is a lot of good friends that have a lot of experience with Bonneville bikes and race bikes in general. I spent literally months on the phone with guys like Wink Ella, Roger Goldhammer, and our tuner, Dan Thayer. Dan Thayer made magic with our bike. When we first hooked up with Dan, he was our tuner and he was our performance guru. Dan gave us a list. He told us, this is what you need to do. So I had a really good crew of guys that worked for me at the time. And we set out to do exactly what Dan told us to do. And we built the chassis. Phil Day from Daytech, who was a good friend, I talked with him for hours about frame length, wheelbase, and suspension. And he was a huge, huge influence on that, along with Wink Ella. So we proceeded to build the bike. And then, of course, R&R up in New Hampshire, they did the motor. We used the Jim's motor with R&R heads. R&R actually built the motor, and they did a phenomenal job. When we finally got the bike done, our goal was basically 200 horsepower could get you to 200 miles an hour. So that was the theory we went with. The first day we tuned it on the dyno up at Dan Thayer's, I think we did 215 horse. We said, wow, it is possible we can go 200. We tested in Loring.
Right. And then it went back on the dyno. We tuned it even more and ended up getting like 230.
Yeah.
235.
Yeah. We
horsepower.
We tested at Loring, Maine, which is an awesome course.
We tested up there with no body on it. It was just they consider a naked bike. So it had no fairing.
Right. And you know, Joe, this is the first time Jody ever got on the bike.
Yeah, first time I'd ever even ridden a high horsepower motorcycle, never mind a high horsepower with a supercharger on it.
Right.
So it was a learning curve.
So that first weekend that we tested, we did it slowly. And by the end of the weekend, she set a new record up there. She ran 164 on a naked bike. And we were just so thrilled. And then we got back from Loring and we started to make all the body and mount the body, which was a huge job.
Yeah, we had less than a month from Loring to Bonneville to do it.
With Sturgis in the middle.
Yeah.
So then we went to Bonneville, and you know, as soon as we got to Bonneville, Dennis Manning, who ran the event, who was an old friend, he grabbed me aside and said, Perowitz, I don't want any showing off here. You're a high profile deal. Everybody's watching you. I want to make sure that she knows how to ride this thing before you try to go any big speeds. So we're going to be watching you and you better take it slow. And I said, yeah, no problem, but that's what we're going to do. Well, shortly after that, Ken from the AMA, he grabbed me and he gave me the same pep talk.
Go 125 and then I could go 150 and then 175.
Yeah. So we did that. Both those guys came over and said, wow, she did a great job. We feel good if she wants to go for it. So that was it. The record at the time, I think, was 178 from T-Man. Well, after about two or three passes, we blew that record away. And then she, you know, she ran 181, 185, 186, 191. And it just kept getting better and better until she made that final pass of 203. And then we couldn't back it up because we sucked a valve.
Being a woman in a male-dominated industry, Jody was accustomed to proving herself. She and Dave credit teamwork for their success at Bonneville and provide a glimpse of what racing at 200 miles per hour is really like.
The first year that we went out there in 2011, there was 313 racers. And out of that 313, there was 19 women. So we don't make up even 10% of the racers out there, maybe 5 on American bikes. So even less females on American bikes than foreign stuff. It's definitely a challenge because this is a man's world. This is a world that's dominated by men. So being a female, it's kind of tough sometimes to be accepted. But I think at this point, I've kind of earned my recognition, I guess you could say, that I'm not questioned so much. But in the beginning, I definitely was. That first year we went out to Bonneville, I can't tell you how many people rolled their eyes at me. And I didn't let it bother me. And I just used it as more determination to make it happen. And it's a team effort. I couldn't do it without them. They couldn't do it without me. And it's all about stars aligning, as they say in Bonneville. And it's yourself, the rider, the motorcycle, the team, the weather, the salt conditions, everything has to align. And us being out there for so many years, I am a firm believer in that, because we had years that we weren't successful. And regardless of whether it was the salt, the team, the motorcycle, you know, whatever it was, it's just, it can't always be perfect, but it does make you come back and makes you determined to keep going and go faster. The thing is, out at Bonneville, when you get that fast, it's so hard to gain a couple miles an hour. And it might not sound like a lot, like from 208 to 210 doesn't sound like a lot, but that's a lot at Bonneville, because I mean, you're pushing your machine so much more and you're only getting small results. So it was like we were constantly chasing just that 1 mile an hour, 1 mile an hour to get faster and faster. That was part of the reason why we built another land speed bike, because we had already maxed out my first bike. The last 9 runs that I did on my purple land speed bike, 9 out of the 11 runs were all over 200. They were 201, 202, 201, 203, 204. They were all right around there. So it was like we were pushing this bike as much as it would go. Granted, you spend money to modify it and to get that 5 miles an hour, or do you build a new bike that has potential to go 20 miles an hour? So that's when we built the new bike to go fast. Unfortunately, that bike still has so much more potential. On that 208 run, I was actually only at 70% throttle. So it still has so much more to go. And you know, maybe someday we'll go back there. I'd like to say that we will, because it's just, like I said, it's got so much more potential. But at this point, I think somebody's going to have a hard time trying to catch my records, besides Jay Allen, who was my mentor for racing.
Oh, Jay Allen was a huge influence.
Yeah.
Whenever we would see Jay, he would just talk about going to Bonneville, going to Bonneville, going to Bonneville. Yeah, Jay was a big influence. You know, he's a great guy. And if anyone was going to take Jody's record, we're glad it was Jay.
Yeah, Jay. So Jay actually ended up taking one of my records, which, like I said, is I'm honored, because he is my mentor for land speed racing. There's so many things about Bonneville that you can only learn from firsthand, from people that have been there and raced there and experienced the salt. And he was certainly one that taught me so much about riding on the salt, because it's just such a different place. It's not like anywhere I've ever been. It's not like riding on anything I've ever ridden on. So I think that all that information that he had given me was so important and crucial, and crucial to being safe about it. You know, knowing reactions and what to do if something happens. That stuff is so important, and you can't Google it. Honestly, I have so much to think about when I'm going down the salt, as far as knowing where I am on the course, because, you know, you could easily get disorientated out there because it's so open and white. Everything looks the same. So it's knowing where I am on the course, watching the flags and what mile marker I'm at, and listening to my bike and, you know, knowing the feels of it. And I don't have a speedometer or anything. I just have a tack. So it's kind of watching the tack and twisting the throttle and making sure that I'm tucked, that I kind of don't think about, oh, what does this feel like? But I can tell you that when you get up to 180, 185, you almost become like you're in a bubble, and it almost gets like quiet. And all you do is you slightly hear the motorcycle, and that's it. And you're so tucked in, holding on with everything you got and twisting the throttle at the same time, that it's just like a different world. Like you're almost like floating out there. It's just such a cool experience just to race out there and be able to say you have records, but then to say you've gone 200 and you're in the 200 club makes it even greater. And I wish I could explain what 200 miles an hour feels like better, but it's not something, it happens so fast. My fastest record in the mile, I'm not sure how familiar any of listeners are going to be with how Bonneville works, but it's considered the flying mile. They clock you entering the mile and exiting the mile, and it's your average in the mile. So my fastest run so far, I entered the mile at 199 and I exited the mile at 214. So to put that in a better perspective, it took me 17 seconds to go a mile. And to break it down even more, it was less than a second to go the length of a football field. So it happened so fast that, like I said, I'm not thinking about what does this feel like, but my biggest thing is holding on. You literally have to hold on with everything you got. And even though I do have a fairing on my bike, it's not holding me on the bike. It's a partial fairing, so I'm still in the open to a point. You literally are holding on with everything you got.
Over the last 50 to 60 years, the custom bike scene has witnessed a number of trends and weathered the industry's booms and busts. Through it all, Dave's business has been nimble and responsive, thanks to his can-do spirit and willingness to be flexible in a changing marketplace.
There's been so many trends. In the beginning, you just made a cool, rigid frame bike with an extended front end, and then it progressed into the Ness style low rider digger, a long skinny bike with no front brake. And that was really a hot style for a number of years. And then as far as I'm concerned, Alan really set the trends. The style that he would come up with next was pretty much the style that I followed, because it was really the cool stuff. We went from doing all old iron head Sportsters to doing shovel heads, running mostly all big twins. And we did slammed on the ground bobbers. And then we did slammed on the ground big fended bike. You know, the whole bagger thing, I bought a brand new FLH in 1994. It was the first one that I ever had. And so I immediately took it all apart, painted it, you know, gave it a whole facelift, which, you know, didn't change a lot of things back then. And we went to Sturgis, and I saw right after Sturgis, there was a picture of me on this bike in Sturgis. And I looked at the picture and I said, holy Jesus, I look like an old man driving this thing. And I sold it and I got away from baggers for, you know, the next few years. But then I went back, and I think in 96, I bought a brand new one, but I stripped it all down, put a set of Mike Corbin's Beetle bags on it. And I did quite a few Road Kings, and I made them look like FXRs. And then, of course, there was the whole FXR. We did lots and lots of FXRs back in the 80s and into the 90s. That was, you know, a style that we did more out here. Now it's the style on the West Coast, FXR. Huge on the West Coast. And then, of course, the baggers started becoming more and more popular. Then they went to the big wheel baggers, which we did, you know, quite a few of them. We don't do any big wheel bagger stuff anymore. It's still going on to a point out there. There's a few guys that are really big into it around the country, but the style is not going up. We're doing a lot of performance stuff, actually just warming up the motors. We're doing soft tails. We're doing a lot of older bikes, shovel head bobbers, pan head bobbers. We're doing a lot of restoration stuff. But as far as where the style's going, I think it's kind of going, as they say, it all comes around. And I think the old choppers are going to come back. The old diggers, I'm really hot to bring the old diggers back. We're working on Dynas and some FXR stuff. So it's all over the place really right now.
These days, Jody's focus has shifted to vintage machines, but her competitive zeal still drives her to finish at the front.
My focus is the Cannonball. In 2018, I teamed up with Curtis Venable, and he provided me with a motorcycle to ride on the Cannonball, which is an antique endurance race. It goes cross country, and you have to be able to work on your own bike on the side of the road. You follow a map. So it's very old school. I rode a 1926 Harley Davidson JD. And fortunately, my bike didn't skip a beat. I rode from Portland, Maine to Portland, Oregon. I was one of three girls that were the first to complete all the miles on the Cannonball. Previous to 2018, no females had completed all the miles. So that was a big accomplishment. And then I started to get involved in the Sons of Speed races, which is circle track vintage racing. In that series, I ride a 1919 Harley Davidson, a 1920 Indian, and a 1951 Harley WR. And that race is no brakes and no gears. So it's push to start. You get up on the track and there's a pace bike and everybody gets kind of behind the pace bike. And then when that flag drops, everybody goes. And it's a whole different ball game. Having no brakes is huge in a circle embanked track, and racing with other guys, not knowing what they're going to do in the corners, and you're cruising in that straightaway, and then you come up to that corner and you don't have any brakes to slow down. So it's more about keeping the momentum. It's not necessarily the fastest bike that wins. And I was fortunate enough to have won a Sons of Speed race in October of 2018. I managed to beat the two-time champion by about a tire's width. That race that I won was on the 1920 Indian. That was pretty cool because my Indian is the slower of the three bikes, but I was very consistent that I could keep that bike wide open and not have to slow down in the corners, because that's when you lose a lot of the momentum. So I've been kind of engulfed in the antique world. My land speed bike is currently on display in the Sturgis Hall of Fame. So we put that land speed racing kind of to the side, but one of the things that I like to say is that I went from 320 horsepower to about 8 horsepower. So dramatically different, but still a challenging thing. Sons of Speed races, we're still going 70 miles an hour around the track. So it's still a fast paced thing. These bikes are 100 years old with no suspension, no brakes, with multiple people on the track. So it's pretty cool. For the 2021 Cannonball, I'm going to be riding a 1912 single cylinder Harley Davidson. That'll be in September, and I'll be riding about 3,800 miles on a 4 horsepower, 109 year old motorcycle. No female has made it the whole way on a single cylinder motorcycle. So that's my goal, is to do all the miles on the 1912. It's a whole lot more than just riding a motorcycle. I mean, these bikes are totally different beasts. You pedal to start and you have to slip the clutch, which is, you know, like a hand lever going uphill. I only have 4 horsepower. So if I go up the hill and the bike can't carry me, I have to literally pedal to keep it going. And if I can't keep it going, I have to pull over, pull it to the side, loosen the belt, take it off to be able to push it up the hill, get it to the top, find a flat spot, put the belt back on, pedal it to start, and then go down the hill, which going down could be just as bad because all I have is coaster brakes, which is like on a bicycle when you pedal backwards. So it's the same kind of brakes on this bike, so minimal. So it should be quite the challenge. I'm really looking forward to it.
When you've achieved as much as Dave, you might think that it's time to back it down and enjoy the scenery. Is retirement on his radar?
No, that's totally out of the question.
He wouldn't know what to do.
If I retired, I'd be doing the same thing.
Yeah.
No, there's no retirement for me.
That's when you get old.
Yeah.
Our thanks to Dave and Jody Perowitz. who will no doubt continue to make their mark on the American motorcycle scene for decades to come. On the Line with the AMA is a production of the American Motorcyclist Association. Since 1924, the AMA has been promoting the motorcycle lifestyle and protecting the future of motorcycling. Learn more at AmericanMotorcyclist.com.